what I wanted to do is I wanted to talk a little bit about why I think WikiLeaks is important. I was at a conference the last 2 days in Stockholm at the Stockholm Internet Forum, which was organized by the Swedish government, discussing issues in relation to internet freedom. And WikiLeaks came up on a number of occasions. And as I see it, WikiLeaks is important for a number of reasons. The first point on my slide is that I feel that there's been an overemphasis on the Assange personality in relation to WikiLeaks, and not enough emphasis placed on WikiLeaks itself as an organization and why it's important. And just a few things off the top of my head as I began to think about this. First of all, what's going on in the United States with Bradley Manning and the crackdown on whistleblowers that's going on right now on behalf of the Obama administration. Despite what a lot of people might think, the Obama administration has prosecuted more whistleblowers, or is prosecuting more whistleblowers, than any other administration in U.S. history. And this crackdown really is an important thing. Second of all, there's a really radical increase in government digital surveillance, which is another reason why WikiLeaks is important, I think, to think about those questions. The long-term implications for journalism, as we heard in the introduction, what WikiLeaks means for journalism, and there's people taking part in this conference, professional journalists who can speak to this better than I can. Also, a breaking of an information oligopoly held by large news organizations. I think that what WikiLeaks in part did and is doing and may do in the future, depending how the organization goes, is forces us to reconsider the role of whistleblowing organizations like WikiLeaks in supplying large amounts of data and what that means for journalism itself and how journalists relate to that volume of data. And that's something to talk about a little bit later. And also, finally, I feel that WikiLeaks restructures a number of fundamental relationships within democratic society. That's also something I'm going to get to a little bit later on. But really, to begin the conference and to begin to think about these issues, I see my role here is in this opening talk to sort of consider some of the key questions and issues in relation to WikiLeaks and transparency. You have participants at the conference who are directly involved in WikiLeaks and can speak far more about the organization and know a lot more than I do. So I see my role here is sort of considering some of the sort of fundamental questions in relationship to WikiLeaks and information. Of course, we're all familiar, most of us are familiar with some of the major leaks that WikiLeaks came out with, the information from Afghanistan and Iraq, the diplomatic cables, the Syrian emails, Stratfor documents. And WikiLeaks was very much associated with the leak of information in relation to military activity and diplomatic activity. But as I was also discussing in the second half of my talk, I mean, WikiLeaks has also been involved in the leakage and the exposure of information in relation to corporate activity as well. It's perhaps a lesser known element of WikiLeaks' activities. But of course, this is a still taken from the collateral murder video that WikiLeaks released a few years ago, probably the most famous single thing that came out from WikiLeaks in terms of sort of popular exposure. And it was a video showing the killing of innocent civilians in Iraq from a U.S. attack helicopter. And this is part of the material that was released purportedly by Bradley Manning. And this is really, I would say, starting about three years ago, the moment at which WikiLeaks really entered public consciousness. It was the massive release of information through a number of major newspapers, as well as the release of this video. And it really sort of signaled a new relationship, as I said, between whistleblowing organizations, between large data sets, and news organizations. For those of you who haven't seen what some of this information looks like, I mean, a lot of people talk about WikiLeaks, but we don't necessarily look at the material itself. What I did was I just went in and I looked at some material about Switzerland, since I'm speaking virtually to Switzerland. And this was some of the diplomatic cables in relation to the minaret ban vote in Switzerland. So, and this was information from Switzerland, from the United States. And it's basically, if you go in and you search for information in the data set, this is the kind of material that you can find. This is from the embassy in Bern. It's a basic document. It's a confidential document outlining information about the minaret band. Here you can see confidential information. You can see here a sort of a summary of what the minaret ban was about. I'm not going to go through all of this, but this is just basically to sort of give you actually look at something that was actually released to see what it looks like. And then you can see here sort of an analysis from the United States perspective of why it's important and what the issues at stake were. You said the minaret ban is an emotionally charged issue in Switzerland, and we important is for the U.S. government to recognize that the Swiss government and the majority of the Swiss parliament had taken clear religious positions on religious freedom. So this is sort of just to sort of think about WikiLeaks and think about the kind of information. This is just a simple example of going in and searching for material and the kind of things you can find from the diplomatic cables. The diplomatic cables have a lot of information, but really, as I said, WikiLeaks made its name on the release of information regarding war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan primarily, and the release of material from the occupation of both Afghanistan and Iraq, as you know. Now, when we're talking about transparency, these are sort of the popular images that began to come out about 2 or 3 years ago in relationship to WikiLeaks. So you can see in the background there on the sign, it says closed to openness and accountability, and WikiLeaks was framed as a flashlight putting light upon organizations and individuals that have generally been in the darkness, at least to the general population. And of course, at the door there you see secrets, there's a U.S. flag on it and the door being opened. And this was the sort of the popular discourse surrounding WikiLeaks at the beginning. And of course, questions began to be raised in the press. And here we see Julian Assange releasing papers. And it says, what does it mean for government transparency? And the answer is, it's still not clear. And so this notion of the release of massive amounts of information, at least in the popular press, became the sort of a key idea that WikiLeaks was basically about dumping information, and it was basically about providing data, but the impact of that release and what it meant was sort of an open question. Like, you know, what is the actual impact of this release, and what does it mean for the general population? What does it mean for politics? What does it mean for society in general? What does it mean for the military? And these are things I think that take time. I think it's difficult to say what the long-term impact of this is going to be, but partially what I would like to discuss a little bit today. I've written some popular articles about this. I'm in the process of writing some more academic pieces about WikiLeaks. And really, it's a fundamental question about what this release of information means. If we look at from the United States perspective, we have some quotes here from conservative politicians after the release of information by WikiLeaks in relation to Afghanistan and Iraq. One is from our famous international diplomat, Sarah Palin, who writes that, Assange is not a journalist any more than the editor of Al-Qaeda's new English language magazine, Inspire, is a journalist. He's an anti-American operative with blood on his hands. And then we've got Bob Beckel from Fox News, who says, we've got special ops forces. I mean, a dead man can't leak stuff. This guy's a traitor, a treasonous. He's broken every law in the United States. That's a huge statement from Bob Beckel. The guy ought to be, and I'm not for the death penalty. So if I'm not for the death penalty, there's only one way to do it, and that's to illegally shoot the son of a bitch. And this is someone saying this on a news program, on a television news program in the United States. And in an editorial in the Washington Times, this is an editorial in a United States newspaper. Jeffrey Kuhner wrote, Assange poses a clear and present danger to the American national security. The WikiLeaks founder is more than a reckless provocateur. He's aiding and abetting terrorists in the war against America. The administration must take care of the problem effectively and permanently. This is some of the discourse that came out from the right-wing press in the United States about 2 or 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. It's worth remembering, though, that this notion about the danger of these leaks is not something that's limited to the conservative right in the United States. As I stated, the Obama administration has been extremely aggressive in the prosecution of whistleblowers and hackers as well, I should say, and other activists. And a number of Democratic politicians, including Dianne Feinstein, have been very outspoken about the need to crack down on the release of this kind of information. So there's been a very, very powerful discourse coming out of Washington about the need to crack down on organizations like WikiLeaks. So freedom of the press and freedom of information is not something that's being considered by the administration in these cases. In fact, quite the opposite. It's a suppression of this kind of information that's seen as fundamental. So what I wanted to do is I also wanted to think about WikiLeaks in relation to social media and empowerment and democratic change, and to take a step back and to think about this in relation to some other global events that have been going on, as you know, in the last 2 or 3 years, primarily the events of the Arab Spring. Because really what's been going on is a discussion about the role of technology in relation to social change. WikiLeaks is part of that discussion, but of course Twitter and Facebook have also been part of that discussion in relation to what happened in Egypt and Iran and Syria and Libya and Tunisia. And within academia and with other circles, there's sort of a fight going on between who are called sort of techno-utopians and techno-dystopians. In other words, people who have a utopian view of technology and people who have a more critical view. Some of you might be familiar with the scholar Evgeny Morozov, who wrote a book called The Net Delusion, who's critical of the idea that the internet is the solution to sort of all social problems. And, you know, what Morozov wrote was that, you know, techno-utopianism is usually rooted in rigid and obsolete views about the relationship between authoritarianism and information. In other words, we have this sort of naive view that authoritarian regimes are somehow non-technical or don't understand technology and are not used to dealing with information. He's saying that's quite the opposite. And in this discussion about Twitter revolutions, which took part, and Facebook revolutions, which took part 2 or 3 years ago, what I wrote was that by talking about it in these terms, there's a problematic assumption when we talk about a Facebook revolution or a Twitter revolution. And that is that in the relationship between individual action and politics and technology, that technology is the key factor. In other words, that action and politics and the things that happen offline are less important than the technology itself. In other words, during the Arab Spring, that technology was held up as the absolutely fundamental key element of these events. And I'm saying that that's a techno-utopian vision. Of course, because governments also use a technology to monitor internet users and their messages, and they've served to rationalize surveillance, disinformation, and repression, as we also heard in the introduction. And in Iran, for example, after the elections in 2009, the Iranian government set up fake websites and proxies in order to lure opponents to provide personal information, which then resulted in them being arrested. Large European companies like Siemens, Nokia, their software and even their hardware has been used for deep packet inspection and surveillance of dissidents in Iran, both text and visual. There was a discussion or possibility that the United States government had contacted Twitter during the Iranian uprisings in 2009 and tried to influence when and how they did updates to their system in order to help the Iranian dissidents. This was actually denied by Twitter, but just the fact that it was discussed in that way. So here we see the way in which technology is held up as being an absolutely fundamental element of political and social change. But of course, on the other hand, we have to recognize the possibilities that technology affords. If we look at Iran and Egypt, for example, of course, technology was used very much for coordination, information about protest locations, government disinformation, warning about activities. Images were used of peaceful protests, and images were also provided of state repression. In the United States, where I come from originally, of course, social media were used extensively by the Occupy Wall Street movement and other grassroots organizations. So, of course, technology had a very central role in these areas. And a good quote that's worth, I think, using as a framework for thinking about WikiLeaks, transparency, and the things that I've just been talking about now is from Giroux, a Canadian scholar, who wrote that state power no longer has a hold on information, at least not the way it did before the emergence of the new media, with its ability to reconfigure public exchange and social relations while constituting a new sphere of politics. And I think that this is a fundamental issue here, which is the second half of this quote. It's the reconfiguration of public exchange and social relations. In other words, to what extent does technology take old power systems and reconfigure them and tip the balance more in favor of citizens as opposed to corporations or governments? And so it's a fundamental question. Giroux is saying that, at least in some small way, technology has taken power away from the state to have absolute control over information. And I think that even people who are critical of the notion that technology is sort of a fundamental element of these changes, I don't think anybody can deny that we're seeing an era right now where citizens and activists really do have the ability to control and to use information in a way that just was not possible even 5 or 10 years ago. Now, in relationship to the WikiLeaks case, I wrote a newspaper article in Le Monde Diplomatique a couple of years ago, and it was called The Three Digital Myths. And it was inspired very much by the discussion surrounding the WikiLeaks case. And the three myths that I noted were the myth of the uniformity of social media, the myth of the death of the nation state, and the myth of the death of journalism. And I think that for the purposes of the discussion today and the conference that we're having all day, it might be worth considering these myths and the extent to which they're still applicable or not applicable. If we look at myth number one, it's the sort of the myth of the uniformity of social media. I think when we discuss WikiLeaks, we tend to discuss WikiLeaks, or at least when I say we, in popular terms, WikiLeaks was discussed as other forms of media or social media like Twitter or Facebook. And my point was we should not think about these things in the same way, or YouTube. Really, we tend to lump social media and technology into one large group, whereas these organizations and groups and companies and websites are radically different. So for example, if we take the third point on the list here, WikiLeaks versus other social media, I mean, WikiLeaks is not like Twitter or Facebook or YouTube. These are places where you can post your opinions, post your ideas. The editorial process is not there, whereas WikiLeaks is a far more well thought out and structured way of releasing information. But we tend to lump these things together as some sort of digital revolution. And my point here is that you really have to consider the architecture of the technology. YouTube is not the same as Twitter, and Twitter is not the same as Facebook. Each of these social media forms, and WikiLeaks is not a social medium in that same way, each of these forms have very, very different structures which enable different forms of communication. And so what you can do on Twitter is limited by the fact that you can only use 140 characters. What you can do on Facebook is limited by the fact that, you know, the way in which the page looks, and also the fact that Facebook sort of owns your data as well. What you can do on YouTube is limited to the number of videos you can upload in terms of length and copyright. So every system has its limitations built into it. And so that has to be recognized. So I think that one of the problems when we discuss social media and digital activism and technology is we should not lump these organizations and groups together under one umbrella. They need to be clearly separated based on the editorial process, what can be done with the technology, and how it can be used. The second thing that the WikiLeaks case made me think about was that within academia, in the 1980s and 1990s, there was a big discussion about the death of the nation state. In other words, that nation states were seeing a reduced amount of power, and that we were seeing the rise of the power of corporations. And that nation states became less important players in the geopolitical arena than they were previously. And you could make the argument that that's true, but I think what WikiLeaks actually showed was that the nation state is still very, very much an important actor in lots and lots of different ways. And so my second point here, that WikiLeaks in relation to the death of the nation state thesis, is that freedom of speech, freedom of the press, protection of sources, these are all things that are inscribed into national law. And law is a result of a nation-state process. So to argue that nation states aren't important, it's to sort of dismiss the importance of the rule of law and dismiss the importance of why certain states offer certain individuals more protection than others. And as you know, some of your participants today know better than I do, I mean, WikiLeaks chose to work within certain nation state boundaries because they were offered certain protections under the law. And of course, so that's one issue about why the nation state is still important, because nation states still make laws that can protect people, and they can also make laws that hurt people. And the second thing is, interestingly, that WikiLeaks is very often exposing things that are also done by nation states. For example, war or illegal killing. So the notion that the nation state is dying and not as important, I think the WikiLeaks case actually kind of brings the nation state sort of back to the middle. Whistleblower laws, treason, extradition. And so I think it's quite important to remember that states still matter and laws still matter. And I think WikiLeaks, despite the fact that it's always very often described as sort of a borderless organization, as an organization it might be borderless, but it also is very aware of the ways in which national laws can be used. And finally, which perhaps is important to some of the people here at the conference, is this notion of the death of journalism. I think that what happened with WikiLeaks was people sort of said, well, this is a great example of why journalism is sort of dead or dying. And I think that actually WikiLeaks, in a way, showed the failure of journalism, particularly in the United States, after 9/11. And I speak now as someone who's from the United States and grew up and studied in the U.S., the failure of U.S. journalism after September the 11th and in the decade after the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan was very noticeable. And I think WikiLeaks is very much a response to that global failure of journalism. But on the other hand, WikiLeaks was also very, very aware of the cultural and the social capital that mainstream journalism still holds. And the release of information about Iraq and Afghanistan through major news organizations such as the New York Times, such as The Guardian, and such as Der Spiegel in Germany, showed that journalism still matters. The notion that WikiLeaks sort of replaced journalism, or that journalism is dead or it doesn't matter anymore, I don't think that was the case, because what you had there a few years ago was a very, very interesting relationship between journalism and WikiLeaks. And I think it's important to remember that there was a period there where there was a very good relationship that led to a lot of fantastic reporting and fantastic information that's still being used by news organizations. I have my third point here, fourth point, that WikiLeaks is not journalism, I see it, but information and collection and archiving. I would say it is a journalistic organization, but perhaps not journalism in the sense of a newspaper. So I think that point has to be, I think I have to rethink that a little bit. But that's, to me, it's not journalism in the sense that the information is collated and explained, but it's journalistic, and it's a news organization in the sense that news is broken and released. So for me, it is an organization that falls under the category of an organization that deserves freedom of press protection. Finally, that there's a place for mainstream journalism, but the power and influence of mainstream journalism has shifted. And where to shift it to, I think, is sort of the point of the conference. So let me go through the second half a little more quickly, because I know we're running out of time here. So the issues raised by WikiLeaks, you know, this notion of transparency as a political philosophy, slacktivism, which is a sort of phrase coined by Evgeny Morozov about this sort of slacker hacktivism and activism, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, you know, what do we mean by journalism, open government and citizenship, control of information, definitions of democratic rights, and then corporate responsibility and sustainability. And just for 5 minutes here, I'd just like to discuss this last point here, because to me, transparency is not just a question of government transparency, but it's also a question of corporate transparency. So an open question might be, how can we transfer this discussion of WikiLeaks in relation to warfare or foreign policy to a discussion of corporate power? In a piece that I wrote in 2012, which was also published by Le Monde Diplomatique, I wrote that former New York Times editor Bill Keller wrote that not much had changed after the WikiLeaks releases, and that the leaks did not herald, as the documentarians yearned to believe, some new age of digital transparency. In fact, if there is a larger point, it is quite the contrary. In other words, WikiLeaks is actually responsible for the more aggressive stance taken by the U.S. government in relation to security and surveillance. Which is a very odd, to me, it was a very odd response from Bill Keller, who had made a lot of hay from his relationship to WikiLeaks, and then later on said it was actually wasn't that big of a deal, and that WikiLeaks is actually responsible for increased surveillance. It seems odd to blame, to me, it seemed odd to blame WikiLeaks for that. And what I wrote in the piece was that actually an alternative reading of WikiLeaks' influence, as opposed to Keller's understanding, is that increased surveillance and security is not evidence of the solidification of old relationships, but a byproduct of changing relationships, or at least the fear of a changing relationship. In other words, why would the U.S. increase both surveillance and security, one would ask, if it did not feel that WikiLeaks was in some way a legitimate threat to their power? So instead of saying, like, WikiLeaks is responsible for increased surveillance, the government is responsible for increased surveillance. And the reason that they're increasing their surveillance is that they're realizing that WikiLeaks is a threat because they're exposing some of the illegal activities. If we look at some of the war crimes that came out from the Iraq and Afghanistan releases. And so what I also wrote was that, and this is, gets to the sort of core of my argument here towards the end, WikiLeaks forces us to rethink a number of core democratic relationships. So number one, between citizens and the state. Number two, between citizens and the media. And number three, between media and governments. And to this, I think we should also say between citizens and corporate power holders as well. And so if we look at just quickly some recent examples of corporate whistleblowing from WikiLeaks, not corporate, but also involving non-governmental organizations, from 2008-2009, there were a number of releases, for example, the World Health Organization Expert Working Group draft reports were leaked, which indicated the influence of pharmaceutical companies within the World Health Organization. In 2009, there was a report on a BBC World Service documentary that was censored, that was then released by WikiLeaks, showing the illegal dumping of toxic material in the Ivory Coast. In 2009, there were leaks showing that the U.S. had shaped the 2009 Copenhagen Climate Agreement through threats and coercions of other countries. In 2008, a Swiss bank, a money laundering accusation from the Cayman Islands. And in 2008, WikiLeaks released members of the far-right xenophobic British Nationalist Party. So these were examples of some corporate, a couple of political in that list, but if we take three or four of those cases, it was involved corporate wrongdoing. If we look at the, if we look at, for example, the discussion about the World Health Organization, James Love, who's the director of the Knowledge Ecology International, wrote the following about the release of information about pressuring drug companies to keep drug prices high, even in developing countries. And what he said was that forcing developing countries to raise the price of drugs has predictable and well-known consequences. It kills people and increases suffering. Many people could care less, including reporters and editors of newspapers. How much of this ends up in the Washington Post, the New York Times, or the Guardian these days? But others who do not care now have more access to information and more credibility in their criticisms of government policy because of the disclosure of the cables. So here we see an example of how some of this corporate and NGO and government-related information can have a positive benefit for activists who are trying to, for example, lower drug costs in developing economies. But at the same time, I think it's important to sort of end the piece here and think a little bit about some of the implications. While it's important to recognize the role of technology, it's also important to have a caveat and to think about the things that are also outside of that technology and the kind of what you need to enable yourself to use it. And so what I also wrote, this is actually about 3 years ago now, at the heart of the myths that I presented earlier, the myth about sort of the death of the journalism and the death of the nation state being the result of technology, at the heart of these myths is the presumption of a causal relationship between access to information and democratic change. And what I mean by that is the idea that merely having access to raw information de facto just leads to change, whether it's radical change or otherwise. And I say that this is as romantic a notion that the mere access to information, to technology can do the same. So it's the idea to just give people the internet and they'll be free. Well, my point was that information, just as technology, is only useful if the knowledge and skills required to activate such information are present. And this is also something that relates to the Arab Spring as much as it relates to WikiLeaks. In other words, that the access to the information and the access to technology is but one component. Question then becomes, how is that information used? And in that way, journalism and activist organizations and political organizations, the way in which this massive amount of information that organizations like WikiLeaks have provided, it then becomes their responsibility to take that information and do something with it if they wish. So rather than having a techno-romantic vision where it's just the information or it's just the technology, there has to be a combination of political, social, economic, and technological factors that make organizations like WikiLeaks have value in society. So I'd like to end there, and I'd like to thank everyone for letting me take part. And my information is here. And if anybody wishes to contact me with any questions, feel free to do so on email or on Twitter. Thank you.